This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. 30 years ago today, President Ronald Reagan signed the North Carolina Wilderness Act. It protected more than 68,000 acres of wilderness. Of course, it was controversial at the time, just as many environmental issues are today. Human industry has historically locked horns with the rest of the natural world. Joining us now is Robbie Cox. As former president of the Sierra Club, he played a part in the story of the North Carolina Wilderness Act. He is a professor emeritus of communication studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robbie Cox, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us the history of the North Carolina. It's federal legislation, but it's called the North Carolina Wilderness Act, right?
Well, that's right, because in 1964, 50 years ago, we're celebrating its anniversary as well, the Congress passed what's called the Wilderness Act, and that created a nationwide system of wilderness protection. And the Congress is the only body that can designate a natural area that has wild characteristics remaining as wilderness. And if a state, such as North Carolina, wishes to protect parts of its national forests, for example, it has to go to Congress. And so in 1984, as the result of a lot of citizens and volunteers, we persuaded the U.S. Congress and then President Reagan to sign the North Carolina Wilderness Act, and that's what we're celebrating today.
Well, I want to get to the effort that it took to get that done, but I need a better definition or a clearer definition in my mind of what is a Wilderness Act, what is the wilderness, and what can be designated a wilderness area.
Well, wilderness as a concept has gone through multiple evolutions over time, from Beowulf and the sense of wild beasts and craggy peaks in the wilderness. But the Congress defined wilderness in the 1964 Wilderness Act as an area that was untrammeled by human influence. In other words, it would be an area that is left alone, no development, no logging, no roads, but it would allow those natural pursuits that are compatible with wilderness, recreation, hunting, canoeing, camping, and simply enjoying the solitude of nature. Importantly, the Congress also recognized the scientific and other values of preserving vast areas that would not be developed. Watershed protection, the reservoir of air that's over areas like the Great Smoky Mountains. These provide other resources and benefits for human beings. And of course, people like John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club, believed that there was aesthetic and spiritual value. Simply in being in the wilderness, one refreshes oneself.
So for the purposes of the legislation, would any untrammeled area qualify, or would it have to be already under federal protection?
Well, the Wilderness Act only refers to what are called U.S. public lands. So a national forest, a national park, a Bureau of Land Management land, those are all potential candidates if they meet certain characteristics. In other words, either they've never been disturbed or, as in the case in the eastern United States and North Carolina, areas that were once logged in the 1800s and early 1900s but have recovered now. Over the last century, North Carolina, Appalachian Mountains have regenerated, and so they have recovered their original wild, you know, primeval characteristics and therefore qualify.
And many of us would think that if you're a national forest or a national park, you're already protected, but there are clear distinctions, right?
Well, that's true. The national forest was developed in the early 20th century as a reservoir to ensure federal ownership of certain lands. It did not mean that they would be national parks. National forests have for decades provided timber resources, multiple uses. And so it takes campaigns by citizens, conservationists, and others to persuade the Forest Service that some of these areas should be set aside, the areas that are the most pristine, that have the greatest value for biodiversity, for example. These deserve special protection. Other areas can still be used for other purposes, and that's the concept now that the U.S. Forest Service operates under.
So tell us about the effort that it took to get Jesse Helms and Ronald Reagan to, in one way or another, support this legislation back in the 80s.
Well, starting in the late 70s, early 80s, a lot of conservationists went into the wilderness to map and explore areas. The Forest Service had not intended in many cases to preserve these lands, but some had been preserved, just they had been left alone. And those volunteers began to develop proposals and shared them with the Forest Service. The Forest Service was under its own mandate to inventory these lands. And together, citizen groups like the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society worked with the Forest Service. We also worked with some of the logging interests to try to develop a common sense plan that would allow some of these areas to remain. By the way, I would correct one thing that you said in your opening. There were 68,000 and some acres formally designated as wilderness, but there's a second category in the North Carolina Wilderness Act that was used. It's called a wilderness study area. And some of those areas, like Harper's Creek and Lost Cove in the Pisgah National Forest, were highly contested by logging interest. But we were able to convince the Congress that, for the time being, set them aside and preserve them as study areas. So they have been de facto wilderness, and as the result, we ended up with almost 95,000 acres of protected lands managed as wilderness in that 84 Act.
Well, and as you suggested, there was some contention, certainly the logging industry not interested in having this ground off limits to them. And in fact, you had a member of Congress who, was it a member of Congress or a lobbyist who was insistent to the point of threatening you about this, right?
Well, I'll leave his name out of the conversation, but a member of Congress from North Carolina, from the Western area, was in his office. I was talking with him about the wilderness bill, lobbying him. And he opened his suit jacket and showed me a holstered 45 pistol and said, "Dr. Cox, I would not go west of the Pigeon River talking about wilderness." That was my first attempt to talk to a member of Congress, but it's gotten a little easier since then.
You did go west, and there was a lot of support there. While there is, so tell us about that effort and who all supported this and how, because Jesse Helms was not initially supportive.
Well, that's true. When we talked with Senator Helms in the hearing before his Agriculture Committee in 1984, he asked how many members of the Sierra Club we had, and I said 2,000 or 3,000. He said, "Well, then I've heard from every one of them at least three times and others." We had civic groups, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, garden clubs, church groups all over the state. There had been an educational campaign to try to just let people know what North Carolina has. And it's not just in the West. In the Uwharrie Mountains, in the Piedmont, the Burkhead Mountain Wilderness was designated. On the coast, in the Croatan National Forest, there were four areas designated as wilderness. In addition to the Nantahala and the Pisgah, of course, everyone knows of those wonderful areas. But the answer is that the Congress and Senator Helms simply heard from a lot of people in North Carolina. Wilderness is a popular idea.
We're talking about the 30th anniversary of the North Carolina Wilderness Protection Act on the State of Things. And I'm talking with Robbie Cox, former president of the Sierra Club, who played a part in the passage of that Wilderness Act. And in fact, you toured the state with a slideshow, which you can, by the way, you can go see the slideshow at our website, stateofthings.org. But tell us about that slideshow and the tour.
Well, one of the tools that we used to try to get the word out, let people know what was out there, was to collect the photos, the slides that people had taken when they've been in these areas. An old maxim of the conservation movement is that you're motivated to protect an area if you've seen it, ideally if you've been there, and you develop a passion to protect it. And we wanted to introduce a lot of those areas, like Shining Rock and extensions to Joyce Kilmer and the Linville Gorge and the southern Nantahala region. These are beautiful areas with enormous value on so many planes. And the slideshow was an effort to just introduce that in a dramatic or graphic way, visual way, certainly. And we toured around the state to show that, the old-fashioned campaigning way before smartphones and Facebook. And we developed a lot of interest, and we took names and addresses, and we said there will come a time when we'll ask you to phone your representative or to write a letter. So we did it the old-fashioned way, but...
Well, as I say, you can see that slideshow on our website, stateofthings.org. Where are we today? I know there's an effort underway to do another inventory and see if there isn't even more land that we can protect.
Well, that's right. The Nantahala and the Pisgah National Forests are now in the process of developing a new management plan for those two forests. And part of that process is that they must inventory those lands in the two national forests that still retain wilderness qualities, but that have not yet been designated as wilderness. So we're in that process now. They will take a look at some of these wilderness study areas to ask if they should be continued, designated formally, or released for logging. Other roadless areas that were left out of these early wilderness bills but now might be considered. And so the time is here again for people that are interested to, let the Forest Service know what you feel. If you visited one of these areas, I think you have special standing to speak to them.
Robbie, good to talk with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
Robbie Cox, former president of the Sierra Club and a communication studies professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Just ahead, the evolution of Mexican-American printmaking on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.